The following is the fourth lecture on the series on the book of Genesis. This was delivered at the Jewish Center on Thursday evening, November 10th, 1960. Last week we finished by asking a number of questions. We're up to the part of the creation of man. You remember that the key verse is here on page 2, verse 26 and 27, 28. Let's take verse 26 and go question by question. Verse 26 says, Vayomer Elohim, and God said, Nase Adam Betzalmenu Kidmusenu. Do you think we ought to stop before the crow witches come?
Well, shall we wait for them? I don't know what time they're going to come.
Oh.
So I couldn't do it.
All right, well, we'll review with them. I was that a little review of the covenant. And God said, Let us make a man in our image after our likeness. The yirdu bidgas hayam, and they shall have dominion or rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heaven. Oh, I will start again then as soon as they come in. This looks more like it. Hello everyone. We were getting a bit discouraged. Well. Eddie, would you sign in and pass it around? Oh, maybe ask Maurice if he has a list.
Before you start, you said I should be reminded this time.
About what?
We were
last time, we asked a series of questions, and one of them was on page 2. Page 2, what verse were we again?
26.
Verse 26. Vayomer Elohim, and God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. And man shall have dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the heaven, and so on and so forth. Now, you notice that there's one interesting variation here. All along, God says this or God says that, and we speak only of God because he's alone. He's alone in the world. And when it comes to creation, he is the creator and no one else. Now, when we have the point of Nase Adam, we have the first person plural. And Rashi, and as well as everyone else, asked the question, well, who is the we? We shall make, or let us make. Who does God take in with himself as the co-creators of man? Are there co-creators of man? Well, Rashi says something very interesting. You have here a very interesting moral lesson. You see how the rabbis took an ordinary verse and found in it something that's of value to human beings. They said, Anvesanuso shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu lamadnu mikan, lefisha adam bedvus hamalochim v'yiskanu bo. Lefichach nimlach bahen. Rashi says that from here you see God's understanding. The word anvasanus here would mean his meekness in the sense that he is understanding and he will come down, bring himself down, lower his own dignity in order to accommodate those who are his subordinates. And it's an interesting picture. Man is made in God's image. So the angels, therefore, are jealous of man, because heretofore they were the only ones who were made in God's image. And so in order to prevent this envy between the angels and man, God decided to consult with the angels first and said, Nasa Adam, let us make a man, so that they would not feel this jealousy otherwise of this new creature, this new young candidate for Tzalem Elokim, who, excuse the... I don't mean it necessarily politically, but it's in the air, you know. This new young creature who is being created and is going to give them competition. So what you see from Rashi, who's quoting the Talmud here, is an interesting lesson. If this is God's behavior, if this is God's conduct, then this is the way man ought to act too. And where he feels that someone else may feel a tinge of envy or somehow or other take offense, then consult him first. Let him be a partner in the deed, so that he will not feel this this personal injury. Very interesting, therefore. God consults the angels in order not to have them feel any kind of offense or envy. But there are other reasons for it too. Let me tell you what some of the other explanations are. Actually, the rabbis already pointed out that a man who is an apikoros, a man who wants to ask strong questions, could pose a strong question here. Doesn't this prove that there are other gods beside God? Nasa Adam means let us. It means that God is not the only creator. But the rabbis tell us that God put it in there at the beginning because he said that this will be self-understood, that such ideas are impossible. But there are several explanations why we do have it then. One, as Rashi told us, is more or less moral or didactic. There's also another explanation, and that is that we are here dealing with the crown of creation, man himself. And therefore, when it comes to the discussion of man's creation, because of its importance, that God uses the royal we. See, when a king speaks to his wife, he says, "I want a cup of tea." But when he speaks to his royal advisors, he says, "We want some tea." There's more of a flourish. There's more dignity. There's something big coming up. You use a royal we. And therefore, Nasa Adam. It means God himself. But he uses this flourish of the first person plural rather than the first person singular. Professor Casuto maintains that in a similar vein, but slightly differently, that because of the importance of man is the crown of creation, therefore the Torah uses Lashon Ziruzin, in the sense of, let's get going. Whenever you use the first person plural, it means a sense of enthusiasm. Sometimes you speak to yourself or think to yourself. You don't say, "Well, I'm going to do this." You say, "Well, let's do this." Everyone cooperates. You mean only yourself. You use the first person plural because of the importance of the project in your own estimation. You have the same thing, those of you who come to shul and say Tachnun. You quote from the sixth chapter of Tehillim. Niplona b'yad Hashem. Let us fall on the hands of God, not fall on the hands of man. Which means let us rely upon God. But David is speaking alone. He's not speaking to anyone else. He means, may I rely upon God instead of having to rely upon man. But he uses the plural. Because the plural always indicates Lashon Ziruzin, enthusiasm, a get-up-and-go attitude. But I think the finest explanation, the one that's really most unusual in my own estimation, is that given by Ramban. Ramban points out that the plural has a very special significance. If you look at the creation of the other creatures, for instance, when the fish were created, how does the Torah express it? Well, let's take verse 20 on page 2. And God said, what? Let the waters bring forth abundantly moving creatures. So what is it that brings forth a creation? God creates from the waters. The waters bring it forth. Verse 24. Tosei ha'aretz nefesh chaya. Let the earth bring forth living creatures. As if God commands the earth, earth, you bring forth. I have nothing to do with it. I'm just commanding you, earth, to bring forth an animal, a rat, a cat, a dog, a skunk, anything. Or I command you, water, to bring forth a shark and an eel and all the other kind of fish. So that it's the earth or the water or the air that brings forth the various things. God, so to speak, doesn't participate in it directly. There's nothing God, particularly godly, about the fish or the animal. It is the earth or the water that is the real origin through the divine command. When it comes to man, then there's something different. Man, says the Ramban, has two creators. Not only the earth, like the animal does, but the earth and God directly. God speaks to the earth and says, "Nase, earth, you and I will co-create man," because man has more than an earthly body. He also has a divine soul. An animal, I can command the earth to create by itself. When it comes to man, then I'm taking a direct part. And that's why you find a little bit later, in the second account of creation, when God repeats it, verse 7 on page 3, chapter 2, verse 7. What happened? The Lord God formed man, how? Of dust from the earth. So again, the earth created, but he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. God adds his own neshama, his own breath into man. Because man is a combination of Eretz and Shemayim, Shemayim v'Eretz, heaven and earth. Man is a combination of guf and neshama, body and soul. Man is a combination of earth, or the organic elements from which he's created, the chemical elements from which he's created, plus the nitzot zel kamimal, the heavenly spark from above. It isn't only earth that creates man. This is, here you have actually a very, very fundamental Jewish belief. And that is that we Jews are not naturalists in the philosophic sense. A naturalist is one who maintains that man is nothing more than natural. There is an animal, there's a apple tree, and there's man. Man is simply a more advanced stage of evolution. But he is only natural. He is only subject to the laws of nature. Therefore, he can be completely exhausted by scientific inquiry. Have you ever heard the expression, the science of man? Well, I'm a great Epicurus in the science of man. I believe there are many things you can discover about man, but you can't learn everything about man from statistics. And this is basically the Jewish position, every really religious position, every theistic position, that man is a, well, shall we say it, an interpenetration of two levels, of two planes. The natural plane, from one point of view, you can study man as you would any kind of object, as you would a tobacco leaf. You can describe him, you can analyze him, you can weigh him. Sometimes when you go through a complete medical examination, you begin to feel yourself as an object rather than as a person. You're being weighed, measured, pumped, pushed, felt. I mean, everything about you is as if you're just another natural object, which we are. We are only we are natural objects. But we are more than only natural objects. And this is the insistence upon of religion, that man has a spiritual side to him. That in addition to the Eretz, the Shemayim, in addition to Adama, in addition to the earth bringing man forth, there is also the Tzelem Elokim. This is specifically where Judaism differs from modern naturalism, or from the naturalistic faith of a number of scientists, who seem to believe that man is only a natural being, only another animal. We agree that from this point of view, which is valid, man is only another animal. But from the other point of view, which is equally valid, man has to be viewed in the light of God, not only in the light of man, in the light of earth. So Nasa Adam Bitzalmenu Kidmusenu means God says to earth, earth, let us cooperate in making this creature who will be half animal and half angel, half earth and half heaven, or half body and half spirit. So you have here the distinctive element of Tzelem Elokim, the image of God, which makes man. Later on, when you find the repetition of the verse 27 on page 2, Vayivra Elokim es Adam Bitzalmo, and God created man in his image, Bitzalem Elokim bar also, in the image of God created he them. So Ramban says, why here do you have only once, only singular? It should be, and they created him. Because here the Torah wants to stress the fact that whereas other creatures are purely natural, man has the distinctive element of a spiritual element in his whole makeup. And therefore the Torah emphasizes, Bitzalem Elokim bar also, in the image of God he created him. And that he therefore possesses this extra something that makes him more than a mere animal, that makes him a thou, not an it. That when you talk to a man, you can't regard him as a thing, as just a means towards an end. No man is a means towards anyone's end. No man should never become a means. Every human being must be an individual whom you respect as something sacred, as a human being who is important because he is created in the Tzelem Elokim. Why does a human being have any value? Why do we treat humans differently from animals? Only because the human being is created in the Tzelem Elokim, because he is more than a natural being, because there's something godly about him. The halacha, in fact the Torah later on, has special laws based upon Tzelem Elokim. Do you know the law? In the original way that the Bible expressed, the Torah expresses the law, is that when a man is condemned to be hanged, so the hanging is done during the day, but before nightfall, you've got to take the body down. Now, this seems to be only a minor detail in capital execution. But why can't a man's corpse be allowed to hang overnight as it was in the Wild West, let's say, or as it may be done elsewhere today yet too? Because it's a tzelem elokim. The midrash gives the analogy. It says it is what can this be compared to? A king who had a twin brother, and the twin brother became a criminal, a notorious criminal, and he was apprehended, and he was doomed to hang. And when they hung him up, people looked at the body and said, "There hangs the king," because he's the twin. So the king ordered that he should be hung and quickly buried, to prevent disgrace to the throne. In the same way, God says, man is the image of God. If man is disgraced, it's a disgrace of the Ribono Shel Olam himself. Therefore, man, even if he's a criminal, must not be treated with contempt. From this, we have the law, and the practice amongst all traditional Jews, that the burial must be immediately, as soon as possible, after death. Again, because to allow a corpse to go just to lie around is a disgrace. We regard it as reprehensible, and therefore burial is always immediate. The same law, the same principle, because man is created b'tzelem elokim. And once the divine spark is gone, then we regard it as busha, as a shame for the body, and we commit it to immediate burial. The word Adam itself, where does it come from? Adam, the name for man. From where? From the earth, which is called what in Hebrew? Adama. Actually, that's what everyone says. But Samson Raphael Hirsch has another interpretation. He maintains it couldn't be that. Why not? Because if man was created from earth, so was a cow. Why isn't the cow called Adam? He was also created from earth. And so he maintains, I don't know how right he is, frankly, insofar as this is concerned, insofar as the scientific aspect is concerned, or the grammatical, etymological correctness of his argument. But it's interesting because it points up something very interesting. He maintains the word Adam comes from the Hebrew word Hadom. Adam, Hadom. What does Hadom mean? Does anyone know? Yes, a footstool. Right. A footstool generally uses whose footstool? God's. Hadom Raglav, God's footstool. We picture God as if he were sitting on a throne. Of course, God doesn't sit on any throne. But in our expression of God's royalty, is God's majesty, he sits on the throne and he has a footstool. So Hirsch says that man is the footstool of God. So the word Adam does not come from his lowly origin, that he's merely a natural creature created of the elements of the earth, but it comes from his elevated origin, that man is actually the footstool of the Ribono Shel Olam. And that you cannot say about any other living being except for man. So he maintains it's not Adam, but Hadam. But again, you see both elements. The natural or lowly origin and the divine origin coming from on high. Man sort of is created by God and earth together, coalescing to create this unusual creature. Incidentally, Hirsch points out that there are two expressions for Adam all through Bereishis. One is Adam, and what is the other? Ha-Adam. Man, or the man, with a definite article. And if you look carefully throughout the story, you will notice that wherever you have Ha'adam, it's a sign of greater importance. The man who was so long awaited, the definite article, the one all of us are expecting and anticipating. Ha'adam is more chashivut, more importance and more significance. The same idea you find, as we mentioned last time, in the words Yom HaShishi, don't you? Do you remember the question we asked last time? On page 3, verse 31 at the top. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, and it was evening, and it was morning, the sixth day, Yom HaShishi. The other days you have Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, Yom Revi. You don't have the hey, the definite article. You're lacking the hey hayadia. Why? Again, because of importance. The sixth day is the day of days. Why?
Man was created.
Because Adam, Since man was created, that day has a special significance, and therefore it's given the Hei Hayadiya, the definite article, which is not done for the other days, because those are merely the development, the unfolding of the natural aspect of earth, of creation, and not the special aspect. Another interesting thing, I just mentioned this in passing. You notice on verse 27, again, I'm just going over the whole sixth day. And God created man in his image, in the image of God. I don't know, am I reading the English correctly? I'm just translating straight. In the image of God created he them. Him, rather. So you have, but God created man in his image, in the image of God created he him. Why do you have twice the word, the same expression? That's the real answer. I mean, that's the literal answer. So, it's emphasis, and if you notice, incidentally, whenever you learn Chumash, this week, next week, or you learn even the Siddur, any quotation from Tanakh, there's one, if you want to tell what is biblical style in Hebrew, there's one distinctive feature, you can even notice it in the English translation, and that is a feature called Hakbalah, or parallelism, that in all Hebrew poetry, a verse is divided into two. Both halves tell you the same thing, approximately, but in different ways. For instance, Yihi l'ratzon imrei fi, v'hegyon libi l'fanecha. Or, mention any verse in Tillim, or from Chumash, a poetic verse. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim v'adabera, v'sishma ha'aretz imrei fi. Hear, let the heavens hear my words, let the earth hear my words. Anything, quote, anything from biblical poetry. Vayivra alakim es ha'adam, b'tzalmo, b'tzalam alakim bara also. God created man in his image, and the image of God created he him. So you repeat the same thing, but in slightly different words. And that parallelism, the balance of the verse, is the distinctive feature of biblical style. A siddur, anyone? Where is it? Is there a siddur there? Just for the fun of it. Any part of it to Hillam. Su'u sha'arim roshechem u'su'u fischei olam. O gates, lift them up, your everlasting doors. Su'u sha'arim roshechem, gates, lift up your heads, and the everlasting doors open up. Yisa bracha me'isa Hashem, may he have blessing from God, u'tzdoka malahe yisho, and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Mi'yale b'har Hashem, who will go up to the mountain of the Lord and who will stand in his holy place? Kichok li Yisrael hu, mishpat l'kei Yaakov. It is an ordinance for Israel, a law from the God of Jacob. Well, I don't have to prove it to you anymore. Do it yourselves. Wherever you have the Torah wants to go into a poetic mood, to an elevated mood, wants to emphasize something, it goes to parallelism. The verse builds up, and parallelly it comes down again. So you have a perfect balance. Sometimes, in the difference, the differences are important. But the very balance is what gives, if you read it in English too, you'll always be able to notice it. If a modern writer in Hebrew wants to write in biblical style, the first thing he does is go into parallelisms. It's the first, and every reader, even if he doesn't know this explicitly as I'm telling it to you, will immediately have the feeling of coming into that biblical atmosphere. Because of the Hakbalah. Similarly here, it would seem to be Hakbalah, because this is so important, the image of God, as we tried to explain last week what that word means, and the three ideas that are in it, the philosophical idea of reason, the ethical idea of what? Of will, free will, and the Kabbalistic idea of, anyone recall? Creativity, man as creator. However, the Orach Chaim wants to say that there's one difference here. The Orach Chaim somehow speaks of two tzlamim, two images. That there are two images of God. One of them is the first half of the verse, and one of them the second. And God created man in his image. All men, no matter how they are and how they look and what they feel and how they act, are created in an image of God. But there are superior individuals who developed that image to a higher form, and that is B'Tselem Elohim Baroso, the image of God. The normal, universal Tselem, which he calls the Tselem HaNikar, the obvious image, and then the special one for especially good people, or holy people, which is the image of God. The difference might be that the universal image is the potential of man for the use of his reason. The image of God is the use of the reason in the right way, for ethical purposes. So every human being has its tselem, but only people who use it properly, who use the reason properly, use intellect properly, can arrive at tselem elokim, at the higher ideal of the divine image. Now, what does God tell man? He tells him in verse 28, blesses him and tells him to be fruitful and multiply, multiply, it's a very good pun, you know, like the flies, to multiply and have dominion, no, and fill the earth, milwas earth, and what is that next word? In Hebrew, v'chiv shuha. What is the significance of this word? To subdue the world. How do you subdue the world? Only by force of arms?
Being master of your environment.
And how today would one be a master of his environment?
Controlling.
How? How?
Maybe subduing oneself, maybe having control of oneself.
Yes, that would be true. That would be subduing oneself. And you're right, the word lichbosh, you're very correct in this, is used in the Talmudic literature as kovesh es yitzro, to subdue one's temptation, which is a very good point. But here it says to subdue it, meaning to subdue the world.
Knowledge of the world.
Well, what is that called today?
Science.
Professor Kish has maintained for many, many years now. You know Professor Kish, he's a member of ours here, but in his philosophy lectures and in his writings, and he's an unusual individual. I don't know how many of you know the variety of this man's interest. You ever realize that he is the, this is quite aside, since he isn't here I can talk about him. He is the curator of the world's only museum of ancient weights and measures in Yale University. Every Monday he's at Yale. So he's the world's greatest authority on this. He is also a leading expert in numismatics and ancient coins, as well as the first man to use electron microscope on the heart tissue as a cardiologist. In addition to this, he has written a great deal about the philosophy of science, especially from the Jewish point of view. He has maintained for many years now, and with a great deal of right on his side, that v'chiv shuha implies specifically God's mandate to man, or his command to man, to engage in natural science. Because natural science is the method that man uses to master the world, to control his environment, to change the weather patterns to his favor. Of course, man can take the same means and use it to destroy himself. But then again, that's the risk that man has. That's the man can use everything that's good you can use for bad. I mean, there is no such a thing as being only good. Every great thing can be used or misused. Take religion. Religion can be the greatest power for the good. It can be the worst thing in the world. The worst thing. Jews don't maintain, as I might have mentioned before, that religion is always a good thing. Not so. Religion can be a terrible thing, depending on what you believe. We can't agree with the current general emphasis, this euphoria in America, that as long as you have religion, it's all right. I, for instance, vigorously disagree with one of the, I don't know who it was, someone who recently, in this recent campaign, who made the statement that any member of any religion should be allowed to become president, but not an agnostic. I don't maintain so. I maintain that agnosticism in some cases is better than certain kinds of religion. I mean, who said that an agnostic is worse a citizen because of it? Or the statement, I don't care what church you belong to as long as you go to your place of worship. What happens if a man worships a snake and tries to take little children and bleed them to death? So his religion? Is it good? Our Supreme Court doesn't recognize it. It doesn't accept these witnesses as proper parents, and it forces them in many cases to protect their children. Jews, I'll give you proof that Jews have not regarded as every religion as being good. The second commandment, no idolatry. The greatest crime is not disbelief in God. The greatest crime is to worship an idol. It's a religion. So we don't believe that all religions are good, because everything that is good can be evil. The more good it can be, the more evil it can be.
I think that's always simplifying it, because when it's stated that way, I don't care what your religion is, as long as you go to church of your choice, that it's understood that the comes within a certain area, and not the a snake worship, for instance.
Yes, I'll agree. I'm doing the reductio ad absurdum. I'm reducing it to the absurd to show the fallacy involved. But before you go to the absurd, you know what the idea is? I don't care what you do, as long as you have some religion, meaning you can be Orthodox, Conservative, Reformed, Catholic, Baptist, Methodist. But I don't agree. You see, because this idea leads to the ultimate idea that all religions are equally correct. You know the broad, tolerant attitude, which is well-intentioned, but does an injustice to religion. That all religions lead to the same goal. Therefore, it makes no difference how you approach it. Well, if that's the attitude, then really it doesn't make any difference what religion you have, then no religion means anything special.
Now,
yes?
Aren't they confusing agnosticism with atheism, where a person that's an agnostic only says, show me, prove it to me, that reminds me of Tsubakhi, because it's not there. They want
No. Don't call an agnostic a misnugget.
But an agnostic is not me, because he doesn't say he doesn't believe in God, he's a prove it to me.
Well, I'll tell you something. Again, I'm saying an idea which is unpopular. As far as I am concerned, from my own point of view, I have much greater respect for an atheist than for an agnostic. Because an atheist has thought through his problem and has the courage of his convictions. Generally, I shouldn't say, I'm not making a blanket statement. Generally, an agnostic is a coward, an intellectual coward. It's the easiest position to defend. He simply says, I don't know, and you can't know. If you can't know, so he doesn't commit himself for or against. You can't argue a position. A man who says the world is meaningless. Well, you can't argue them anymore. Nothing is good and nothing is bad. If a man has thought a problem through and has convictions, you can engage him in an argument. Or at least he can act upon a certain principle. He can live his life out on a certain principle. An atheist has very definite beliefs, who can have very definite beliefs about the nature of world, man, and so on. An agnostic who believes that you can never know chooses the way of ignorance. Now, if a man says, I don't know yet, that's not agnosticism. Agnosticism means he says you cannot know. You can't argue with that position. And besides, it's easy. Any young person, beginning, who doesn't want to commit himself to a way of life, who finds it easier to retreat into a position which he doesn't have to defend. Agnosticism does not have to be defended, because you have to start proving it to him. You see? So to my mind, it's only a piece of intellectual cowardice. I have no respect for it. Besides, as William James once said, there is really no such thing as agnosticism. To be an agnostic means to suspend your judgment. I'm going to suspend my judgment. I don't know if there is a God. If there isn't a God, I'm going to suspend my judgment. But this is all right in conversation. We're sitting around a table, and we've all had our dinner, and we're getting together for a discussion, so you suspend your judgment, and I don't suspend my judgment. We can talk this way. But when it comes to living in life, and this is pointed out by James, who was no great tzaddik, when it comes to living out your actual life, your decision has to be either one way or another, as if you believed in God or as if you did not believe in God. Let me just finish this one idea. All through life, you have major decisions to make. Now, you may say you cannot know, but you either act as if you were a deeply religious person, or you act as if you were an atheist. For instance, shall I put on tefillin tomorrow morning? I've got a problem. Now, if it's more than a matter of laziness, but if I really am going to make up my mind on the basis of a human free will decision, if I say I don't know, I have suspended my judgment. So what do I do? Do I put on tefillin or don't I?
No.
I don't put on, then I've acted like an atheist. Do I put it on? Then I've acted like a religious Jew. Like I said, I do believe. So whatever I do, I've got to act one way or the other way. You see, argument you can suspend, but action you can't suspend, because you have to simply put yourself into a deep freeze, not get out of it until you've thought through your problem. That's why James maintains also that agnosticism, in an abstract way, may be a respectable position. But if you want to act on that basis of that belief, you can't. So agnosticism is a very unreal position to hold. So that when they deny it to an agnostic, I'm saying atheist, because to me there's no difference. But coming back to our original discussion, what I'm trying to say is that everything great can be demeaned and distorted and misused. Similarly, v'chiv shuha, God tells man to conquer earth. The way for man to conquer or subdue earth is through knowledge or science, which is what science means, knowledge. And therefore he can use it or he can misuse it. And we have seen instances of both in our own days, of course. Now, just one final remark about the Yom HaShishi, the definite article, as I mentioned to you, because of the importance of man, there's one more interesting comment that the rabbis make. They say, Yom HaShishi, the sixth day. Why the sixth day? They say because the Torah meant to indicate, in a very indirect form, that the sixth day of creation is equivalent to what other sixth day? What other sixth day is important in the Jewish calendar? Well, that's the sixth day of creation. Sixth day of what month is a holiday? Sixth day of Sivan, the Shavuos. The sixth day of creation is parallel to the sixth day of Sivan. To show you what? That the purpose of the creation of man, which was the sixth day of creation, is what? Torah, which was given on Shavuos. Yom HaShishi. Man and Torah. The sixth day of creation, the sixth day of Sivan. Telling man, and this goes right into our own discussion, that he has a choice. You cannot have a middle ground. It's either Torah or Tohu Vavohu. Either Torah or chaos. And you've got to make your choice. So that man has either Breishis, either Sheishis Yimei Breishis, which begins with chaos, or the sixth day of Sivan, which is Torah. That's why frequently in the Talmud you find the expression. For instance, the Talmud tells us, I think I mentioned it in the center several weeks ago, that when the Torah was given, God took the Torah, took Mount Sinai rather, and held it over the Jews, and said to them, this is a gentle piece of blackmail, and said to them, Im tekablu as a Torah mutav, if you accept the Torah, good and well. V'yimlav, if you don't, achazir es ha'olam letohu vavohu. There are two versions of that Gemara. One says, Sham tehei kvuraschem, this will be your burial place. The other one says, if you will not accept the Torah, achazir es ha'olam letohu vavohu. I will return the earth, make the earth revert to the primordial chaos. Why? Because the choice is between chaos and Torah. Between Torah and Tohu. These are the two elements that man has to choose between. So the Yom HaShishi, why the sixth day? Because it's the sixth day of creation, Tohu Vavohu, or Torah. One or the other. Well, after 4 weeks, we finally finished the 6 days. Now we proceed to Shabbos. Now we rest. I should declare a holiday. Very good. On page 3, beginning of chapter 2. Vayechulu hashamayim v'haaretz v'chol tzva'am. And the heavens and the earth were finished. V'chol tzva'am and all their hosts. What does the host mean? All that accompany, all that is within heaven or on earth. It means the stars, the planets, and all that is contained on earth. And God finished on the seventh day all the work which he had made. And he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had made. Do you notice the parallelism? And he finished and he rested. And God blessed the seventh day and he sanctified it. Because on it he rested from all the work which God had made. Well, 3 verses. How do we recite these verses when we make Kiddush? What position do we have? We stand, right? Why stand? Because according to the halacha, and this is interesting, it's important to know when you make Kiddush. According to the halacha, when a man comes to court to testify, in our civil courts, what's your position? You sit, you raise your hand, the clerk swears you win, and you go on. In a Jewish court, more similar to an English court, the witness stands during testimony. Because Haggadah's Eidus is Ba'amida. All testimony is given in a position of standing. Because of that, you have to stand when you make Kiddush. Because when you recite the words Vayechulu, you are giving testimony that God created the world and he rested on the seventh day.
Yes.
That's right. They sit for the Kiddush itself, but for the Vayechulu they stand. No. Because the Vayechulu is the testimony. I'm saying, and all the heavens and the earth were finished, which means God created them. And God rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had made. Which means that when you make Kiddush, you are testifying to your family, to whoever happens to be present, that God is the creator of the world. Well, if you're testifying, you have to stand. So that these three sentences, therefore, are very important. They are the testimony of the Jew. And this is the essential meaning of Shabbos. The meaning of Shabbos, incidentally, is not so much that God rested, as the fact that God rested from creating. If God rested, you know that he was a creator. Otherwise, you wouldn't know that he created. So that the Shabbos is not only for resting, but also to tell you that prior to the resting, there was creation. So let's take this word by word, because they're very important. Vayachulu hashamayim va'oretz v'chol tzvaram. And the heavens and the earth and all the hosts were finished. Vayachulu. The end of creation is celebrated, therefore, by Shabbos. And a Shabbos man has to rest, yes? This is the Shabbos, this is the meaning of rest. Well, why do we have to rest? True, because God rested, but then we don't have to create trees because God created trees. What's that? We are in his image, yes. But our resting, in addition to the fact that we imitate God, has an additional motive. And that is, it relates to the creation too. It comes to show us one thing. During the 6 days we work, and all of us, being human, are sooner or later prone to be obsessed with our own powers of creation. We tend to think that without us, the world can no longer survive. After all, we have to do the job. I'm irreplaceable. I'm indispensable. So the Torah tells us, 6 days you work. On the seventh day, you stop working and realize that the world will survive without you too. You are not the master of the world. You can't do it all by yourself. God created the world. When you recognize that on the seventh day by yourself ceasing from labor, then you realize your own place in the whole scheme of existence. You know where you are. You know that you're important. You created B'Tselem Elokim. But you are not Elokim. You are not God. The world can survive without you. This, incidentally, is important for all us who, all us moderns, especially New Yorkers, who tend to overwork and sometimes get into quite a state of anxiety and nervousness because we're convinced that we've got so much to do, we're never going to get it done. But Shabbos should remind us that you're not going to get it done anyway. And so that one day a week we ought to really relax and understand our own position spiritually, that we are not the masters of the universe, and we have only so much we can do, but we can't do everything. Heschel puts it very well. And this comes back to what you said before. He says, 6 days you work and you dominate the world. The seventh day you rest and you dominate yourself. When you learn that you cannot dominate the world, then you have dominated yourself. The word vayachulu is interesting, isn't it? What word of Hebrew does it remind you of? What's the word you use to a young man when you think it's about time he got married, huh? No, but what, one word. We say, well, what is the word you use? Tachlis. What does tachlis mean?
Result.
Purpose. Result, in a sense. And you'll see in a minute how you're right. But actually the word means purpose. What does vayachulu therefore mean? That the purpose of all creation was Shabbos. That's what Hirsch says. Vayachulu. After all, there are many words for finish in Hebrew. Vayistayimu, vayigmaru, vayigamru. Why vayachulu? Because the word tachlis, the word and they were completed, has the connotation. This was the end. Look at the English word, the end. Doesn't it have two meanings? End meaning finished, and end means what else? Purpose, like means and ends. Vayachulu means finished in the sense of the purpose was achieved. So the purpose of creation was Shabbos. Prove it from the davening. From the Friday night davening. Ata kidashta, how do you say in the Shemoneh Esrei? Es yom ha-shvi, tachlis shamayim v'aretz. We say to God, you sanctify the seventh day, tachlis shamayim v'aretz, the purpose of heaven and earth. Shabbos, the holy day, is the purpose of the creation of heaven and earth. So you see that the Shemoneh Esrei, the prayers, prove Hirsch's point, that vayachulu was specifically used because of the word tachlis. Now you know that the idea of Shabbos as the purpose of creation is a rather new idea. You know what? There was a Greek Jewish philosopher called Philo. Philo Judaeus of Alexandria. He lived about 2,200 years ago in Alexandria, in Egypt, which was very Greek, very un-Egyptian. It was a very Greek city, dominated by Greek philosophers. You know what Philo says? Why should we rest on the seventh day? A very modern idea that some people who are very unacquainted with Judaism will advance. You rest on the seventh day in order to get energy and rest so you can work better the other 6 days.
Isn't this the... They worked all 7 days.
No, no, but Philo himself is giving a rationalization of the seventh day. Why do you rest on the seventh day? So he says you rest one day to recoup your energy so you can work better the other six, which is a fairly modern idea. Many people will take this one day off so they can get a... It's like going to a health club. You take 2 hours off so you can work better the rest of the day. You have one day of the week so you can work stronger the other 6 days. This is basically a Greek idea. Why Greek? You relax. So what does Shabbos mean, therefore? Relaxation.
Menucha.
Yes, relaxation. I'm going to come to menucha later. It's a special word. You relax in order to be able to work better. What does this mean? In the hierarchy of values, this means that Shabbos is way down on bottom. It's only a means to an end. What is the higher end? Working on the other 6 days. So Shabbos, the purpose of Shabbos is the other 6 days. What do we say? Reverse. The purpose of the 6 days is Shabbos. Not that you rest in order to work, but you work all week long so you can rest on Shabbos. Shabbos is the purpose. That's why when you say the Yom every morning, what do you say? Hayom Yom Rishon B'Shabbos, the first day from Shabbos, the second day from Shabbos, the third day from Shabbos. Shabbos is the center. What did their ancient rabbis do, Shammai and Hillel? You found a good piece of meat, choice piece, you put it away for Shabbos. You are Mechan, that's why you have to prepare from Shabbos, from weekday, for Shabbos. That's why you have to have your table covered and your candles set before sundown. You prepare from weekday for Shabbos. Shabbos is the Tachlis. Vayechulu is Tachlis. That's why, incidentally, there's a special law, in addition to the 39 categories of work on Shabbos, a special law of Isser Hachona. You cannot prepare from Shabbos for weekdays. Let's say you're going on a trip Saturday night. Is there any violation of melacha, of work on Shabbos, to pack a trunk? None. It's not riding, it's not smoking, it's none of the others. You can't do it though. Why not? You cannot prepare from Shabbos for weekdays. You can't, because that violates the sanctity of Shabbos. It means that the purpose of Shabbos is the weekday. So the Torah, the halacha tells you pack it Friday afternoon. But Shabbos is an end in itself, vayechulu, an end, tachlis. And you don't use it as a means for the other days. So that Shabbos is not relaxation. Shabbos rather is what? Recreation. In the real meaning of the word, recreation. You create yourself again. All week long, the Adama aspect of man is expressed. Work. And what does man work at generally in the primitive sense? The earth. Shabbos, you recreate the Tzelem Elokim. You give the spiritual element a chance to blossom forth in its own right. So this is the difference between the Greek and the Jewish concept of Shabbos, if the Greeks would have had a Shabbos concept, or as they did in Philo's form. For them it was relaxation. For us, it's recreation. Now there's a very difficult question with regard to Shabbos, to the second verse. What does the second verse say? What does the second verse say? The beginning. Ve'yachal Elohim b'yom hashvi malachto asher asa. And God finished on the seventh day his work which he had made. What does that mean? If he finished in the seventh day, that means he worked through to the middle of the seventh day. If I say that I finished working on Shabbos, it means I worked on Shabbos in the middle of Shabbos, I finished. Doesn't that mean that God worked on Shabbos?
He created on Shabbos.
He created
Shabbos.
That's good. That's one. We'll come to that later. That's true. That's what Rashi says. Bara Menucha. He created peace. He created rest. But actually, there are a number of other answers, which are also important in their own way. Sforno is a 16th century Italian physician who, as a doctor, was pretty good, but his real fame is because of the commentary he wrote on Chumash, which is... really wonderful. Sforno maintains that God finished on the split second between the sixth day and the seventh day. He relies upon the Talmudic passage that only God can tell the exact, can make a split second decision, a decision as to which split second belongs where. Man can only approximate time, but it can't come down to an ultimate decision. Actually, this is a bit of relativity. The Chachmei HaTalmud didn't realize it. One of Einstein's two theories of relativity is that no human being can prove simultaneity. that two things are simultaneous. Approximately, we may say it's simultaneous. I put my fingers down simultaneously. But to prove it, from the point of to the satisfaction of science and mathematical theory, can never be done. No simultaneity can ever be done. So the halacha has the same point, that human beings can only approximate, and therefore, the law is that you have to light your candles 18 minutes before sunset, which is the time you have for lighting candles, is an 18-minute period prior to sunset. And we have to observe it very carefully. Only God can be metzamtzem, can tell the sixth from the seventh day accurately. Man cannot. Ibn Ezra has another explanation, which goes to the grammatical source. Vayas, he did, means continuous. If it had said Vayas alekem b'yom ha'shvi ma'achta ha'shidasa, he worked, he did, that has a continuous. Vayachulu means completion. So the word he would translate Vayachal alohim b'yom ha'shvi, and God completed on the seventh day, which means by the seventh day it was already done. There's a special connotation. Not that he did up to then, but by that day it was already done from a prior time. But I think the best and the most important answer is Rashi's. And that is what you have said. Bara what? And what did God create in the seventh day? Bara menucha. God created rest. Well, that's a remarkable thing. What does rest generally mean? Rest is generally a negative idea. You don't work. But if God created rest, then what does it mean? That rest is a positive idea. That there's something very positive and affirmative to the whole concept of rest. It's not merely giving your muscles a chance to relax and doing and thinking nothing. But rest, on the contrary, is a chance to think in different channels, to have a different kind of activity from the usual. This is a very good basis, you know. Real relaxation, a real rest, is not when you just lean back and do absolutely nothing. Because sometimes people cannot do just nothing, especially people who live in a busy society. But it's a change of activity, a change of scenery, a change of venue. Whether it's touring, whether it's a hobby, whether it's putting tiles into place, or hacking away with a hammer and a saw. But if it's a different kind of activity, then it's rest. But it's very positive. You produce something. As a matter of fact, we live in an industrial society where each man does only one very little piece of a job. And very few of us are artisans where we completely fashion a thing. We don't have the satisfaction that comes from real creativity. One man just pushes a button, another man bangs down with a hammer, and no one ever really creates the whole thing as once was done. So this kind of change of activity, where you actually make a pair of bookends all by yourself, gives you the satisfaction of creativity. So bara menucha, it means something very definite.
How can you do it on Shabbos?
No. I'm giving it very true, of course. It's a good question. But I'm giving an example of how rest can be positive. Now, this is an example in physical creativity.
How is rest positive on Shabbos?
Oh, very good. You tell me.
Can I say something?
Study.
Taking your mind off on
stuff. Yes.
Taking your mind off the worldly things. Of the
that's it. That's it.
Transplanting it to Torah or something.
Precisely.
Or anything.
A different kind of activity. A different kind of mental activity. A different kind of study. All week long, you study your science and your Latin and French. Shabbos, you study something else.
What happens if you study
German,
Torah
Spanish?
What?
Very true. Very true. You study a different kind of Torah, different passage of the Torah. No, generally it's so. Generally it's so. You find people who are students, on Shabbos will have a separate form of study. All week long they study Gemara. Shabbos they study Zohar. All week long they have one shir, Shabbos they'll have another. Shabbos there should be a shinoi, the day should always be different, on a different level, different kind of activity. Actually, the idea of spiritual creativity, and I should emphasize, as you say, spiritual creativity, well, you have it, a mincha. What do you say in the mincha Shabbos? Yakiru varnecha v'yedu, let your children recognize and know what? What are the next words? Come, gentlemen. Ki me'itcha hi menuchasam. From you comes their menucha, their rest. Menucha comes from the Rabbana Shalom. It's a very positive idea. There's the element of spiritual creativity. Now this has certain consequences, certain proofs. The halacha regards not working on Shabbos as a mitzvah asay, as a positive as well as a negative commandment. Negative commandment is not to work, but to rest is a positive commandment. One of the 613. What does it mean to rest positively? It means more than just not to do something. It means to do something that is creative on a higher level, not physically. philosophically, it means that menucha, rest, is a tachlis. It's the purpose of the whole week's work. We don't rest in order to refresh ourselves, as I said before, for the week's work. But the whole week's work is for the higher purpose that on Shabbos we should be able to devote a little time to something more important. Which means that it's good to sleep on Shabbos, but it shouldn't be our only activity. I mean, I'm not saying Shabbos we should sleep. You know what they say, Sheen Bey's tough, Shabbos Bo Tishon. Shabbos you ought to sleep. There's nothing wrong with it. But there also ought to be a little bit, the day has to have a different character. That's why people frequently say to me, I put on the television set Erev Shabbos, can I keep it on all Shabbos long? Well, it's amazing. I mean, a great majority of people, I think, do that. And yet, I mean, isn't Shabbos? You're not working. True, you don't violate Malacha on Shabbos.
It's not Shabbos day.
It's not Shabbos. And what does it mean to be Shabbos day?
You do it all.
The day is different. My God, this infernal machine terrorizes us all week long. You know, there are 101 things you might do if not for that irresistible temptation to turn the knob and see it again. And frequently you hate yourself when you do it. You know you don't want to, but it's like a shikim at Brunson. You know, we have to have a television viewers anonymous to learn how to... Well, Shabbos is the time to do it. I mean, the same thing with the telephone. I know there are many people who answer the telephone on Shabbos. I'm not concerned now with the violation of Shabbos insofar as work is concerned. But I maintain... Personally, if someone would ask me, tell me, Rabbi, what is your personal view of Shabbos? Forget about preaching, about Shabbos, about shul. I would say, personally, the greatest thing about Shabbos is not answering the telephone. You know, all week long, you have a compulsion to do it. You don't want to, but you know you've got to answer the telephone. Recently, I read where did I read it? A woman called up a psychiatrist in a dreadful panic. She said, my husband is standing at the window ledge. He's going to jump out of the window. And she says, please hang up, and I'll call you in a moment, and don't answer the phone. And he phoned up, and he heard it, and he walked back to answer the phone. He was in the commit suicide, and there's something very true. We are compulsive about this. I know I am. Compulsive about that infernal machine. We have to answer it. Shabbos, I know it can ring. I'm not worried about emergencies. If it's an emergency, they'll call a telegram, they'll call the police. No one's going to bother me. Whoever knows me already has been trained by now that I don't answer it. It's the most wonderful, peaceful feeling in the world. You know, you're away from the weekday activity. The telephone is, after all, a sign of business. It's primarily a business machine. The television set, the radio. You're away from all this. And even if it's only sleep, let alone spiritual activity, study, even if it's only sleep, the day is different. It is really a positively more peaceful day if you can tear away from the technological demand that society makes upon us all week long, which we have to respond to. Shabbos, we liberate ourselves from this technological tyranny to which we're subject all week long. Then, in a practical sense, Shabbos tells us something about the use of leisure. The problem of leisure is that I don't want to go into it now. I gave a talk with our young marrieds last spring, Moshe? And it's going to come out in an article this coming fall. But it's a very important problem. We are the leisure class today. Even the industrial worker in a factory is a member of a leisure class. The industrial worker 30, 40 years ago didn't have coffee breaks as part of a union contract, 2 coffee breaks. He didn't have the easy pace of living compared to what workers once had. So that today, even people who are not official members of the leisure class have a great deal of leisure. What do we do with that leisure? How are we to use it? Are we to spend it only in entertainment? You know, entertainment after a while becomes a disease. It's good within limits. But after a while, we go on an endless round, and after a while, nothing satisfies us. We've heard all the jokes. We become harder to tickle into laughing, harder to please. Comedian after comedian fails. They can't go on too much. And we become bored. Bored not only to distraction, but bored literally to insanity. Entertainment is not a solution to leisure because it has its limits. If it's used in small doses, it's effective. In large doses, it's like using a large dose of antibiotic. It loses all effectiveness after a while, unless it becomes simply a habit-forming drug. So there has to be a creative use of leisure. So Shabbos, in other words, must not only be not doing, it must be a positively creative aspect in the spiritual sense. From Shabbos, we may learn what direction to follow in the use of our leisure through the week. We have more than one day now. We have 2 days and it will soon be 3 days and maybe 4 days. One of the great problems about automation is, what in tarnation are we going to do with all that time? It's going to become a real problem, because as we have more time, we have time to kill. We begin to kill ourselves, psychically and psychiatrically. So that it's a very important problem as to how we are going to use the leisure hours at our disposal. Finally, just one mention. What is the word for happiness in the Bible?
Simcha.
Simcha, sason, as you say. Simcha, what else? You know, there are many words in Hebrew for happiness. You can tell that the Jews are a very happy and optimistic people, not only, as we said several weeks ago, that in creation you have a constant refrain, ki tov, which is the optimistic refrain, but also by the number of words we have for happiness. Sason, and the wedding ceremony. Asher bara gila, rina, ditza, chedva, sason, simcha. Look at all those words you have. You must have about 16 or 17 words for happiness. But in the Torah, not alone later Hebrew, but in the Torah, in the early part of the Torah, what would you regard, or in certain parts of the Torah? You know what the word, I think the word for happiness would be in its deepest sense? Menucha. Menucha would regard, I would regard as the highest form of happiness. Real, serene happiness. Menucha doesn't mean monastic.
No, I mean in itself.
I don't think they ever identified monasticism with menucha or with happiness. The idea of happiness is rather strange to Christianity.
No, but I wasn't thinking of it in that sense. The exact translation of the word menucha, you often hear people, somebody trying to seek peace in
to seek peace, yes, I know. Yes, that's true. Perhaps. But you know where I find it? In the famous psalm, the Lord is my shepherd. Hashem roi lo echsar. What does he say? Almei menuchos yinahaleni. He leadeth me beside the
still waters.
Mei menuchos, the waters of menucha. Because the still waters means where life is no longer turbulent, it isn't the turmoil. No telephone, no television, no business appointments, no shopping. Everything is quiet. And in this quiet, man can come to himself. I mean, all week long, don't forget, our social contacts, our business contacts. We're so torn apart by contact with society that we don't know really who we really are. You know, if you find yourself alone for an hour sometimes without any kind of contact with the outside world, you begin to look into the mirror and say, who am I? Well, who am I? You don't know who you are because you begin to identify yourself. Your whole self-identification soon is elaborated in terms of other people. I am so-and-so's son, so-and-so's husband, so-and-so's father, so-and-so's business associate, so-and-so's colleague, so-and-so's customer, so-and-so's competitor, and so-and-so's supplier. And the other one's golf partner. We identify ourselves only in terms of relationships. Sooner or later we want, but who am I besides the relationships with other people? Who am I as an individual? And that we forget. Mei menuchos, the still waters, means when no one is here to perturb my presence. And I am myself. And when I am myself as an individual per se, then my relationships with others can be more meaningful. Otherwise, I'm nothing but a bundle of, well, like the best analogy I can give is in the central room of a telephone or telegraph company or any high industrial setup where all wires meet. They don't meet with anything in specific, they meet with each other. We're just a central nervous system which goes out to others, but we are nothing in ourselves. When we learn that we have to be something by ourselves in addition to our relations with others, then our relations become more intelligent and more meaningful. This is the main menu. This means menucha. Menucha means to be something without contact with others, without having our peace impinged upon by others. When we can make our Selam Elokim felt in our own eyes, then we can go to the world and find happiness in our relations with other people. Perhaps.
And then what would be, you said the menucha, I say it was rest, you say it happiness. Is it, what form of happiness would ecstasy be then? Because ecstasy is in the Torah.
I don't think ecstasy would be happiness necessarily. I'm using the word happiness in a very definite, as I mentioned, there are 16 to 17 words. For instance, sason is a much more active form. But I'm using it in the sense that there must be a core within us. We're so busy, all of us are like we're vibrating constantly, we're always running around. there must be something in man that should be an element of silence. There must be a stillness within each individual, and we have to strive to find that silence where there's no speech, there ain't omer ve'ain dvarim, there are no words, no speech. There's a quiet. Then there can be a storm around about it. Otherwise, if you don't have that core, then we lose the whole humanity that should be ours. I think there's an element of psychological health as well as spiritual health involved here. That within we have to have a strong element of stillness. Then we can survive the world with all its demands upon us and all its challenges, its frustrations and so on.
You think they're hinting at introspection, the time where you are devoted to your inner thoughts and feelings, not related to the outside?
Yes, very much so. Introspection, definitely. But you know that introspection, if you have not developed that stillness that I'm talking about, introspection can become a very bitter experience. Many people refrain from introspection because they're afraid of what they're going to find. And primarily they're afraid that they're going to find nothing. I mean, the greatest problem that man faces today is that if he gets away from his round of activities, from his routine, and maybe that accounts for his fanatical desire for entertainment, he's afraid to be by himself for a moment. Because if he is, he'll suddenly discover how empty he is, how meaningless life is. I don't mean empty in the sense of being a boor. I mean that in sense of value. What am I living for? We're afraid to ask ourselves fundamental questions because we have never taken the time to develop fundamental answers. And mind you, if you never ask a fundamental question, you can never have fundamental value. Well, that is the major idea of Shabbos. Of course. I'm not saying a man should have only introspection. After a while, it's a sign of egotism. If all I do all my life is wonder about myself, then I'm not aware of anyone else's existence. But certainly, we have to have a cheshbon nefesh, a chance to look at ourselves. And I think Shabbos... I'll give you another example, another reason why I think Shabbos means that. Moses tells the people, Al teitzu ishmi bateichem yom ha-Shabbos. Do not... Al yetzu ishmi makomo b'yom ha-Shabbos. Not to leave his place on the Shabbos. That's why on the Sabbath we're not allowed to travel. Not only travel in cars, but you can't travel, let's say, if you live in a village. You can only go a Sabbath's journey, 2,000 cubits. That's the Tchum Shabbos. You can't, let's say, walk a dozen miles from one village to another on Shabbos. You've got to stay in your place. Again, the idea of Shabbos is a day for yourself, your family, but not to make the outward connections that dominate us all week long.
Why? Maybe because it's a city, I mean, but in itself. Although, if you walk, let's say from, some people do, they walk from one end of Manhattan.
That's permissible, according to the law. A city is regarded as one unit.
No matter how large.
Oh, yes. That's all right.